Hi, I'm Professor Allen.
And I'm Emily, and you're listening to the Short Box Showcase.
Episode 20, Feedback, the Future, and a First Appearance.
Our last two episodes were part of the epic super duper Michael Bailey crossover event. We covered...
Of awesomeness.
Of awesomeness. We covered John Ostrander's late 90s miniseries, The Kents. Through the wonders of social media, we got some feedback from a very surprising listener. John Ostrander.
Now, this was totally on Michael Bailey, because he and John Ostrander were connected on Facebook before this. I don't know if they'd ever had a conversation or a back and forth, but they were Facebook friends. So when Mike released that middle section of the crossover on Views, he tagged John Ostrander. And a day or so later, he had commented on Mike's link that he liked both episodes and was looking forward to a third.
I'm just glad that we were done with it by the time that this happened, because otherwise I would have been freaking out epically during the record. I'm like, oh my gosh, he's actually listening to it. I've got to make sure that I'm being totally, I've got to go over all of my notes again. I'd be all flustered.
Fortunately, there was no horrible, awful things we said about him that we had to cut.
Yeah,
because
it didn't take a sudden nosedive exactly. In issue 11.
Because it was an awesome series, awesomely written. Now, even for a veteran podcaster like Michael Bailey, he was stoked about this development. And when we learned, we were excited, of course. As a matter of fact, Emily, one of us squeed like a 13-year-old.
And I was pretty excited.
Oh, yeah, that was me squeeing.
Yeah.
That's right. I remember that. Now, after the final episode of that crossover, Mr. Ostrander, I feel like I need to call him that now.
Yeah.
Because he's been so kind and generous. He contacted Emily and I and thanked us for our coverage and invited us to ask him a few questions if we had some. So again, extremely gracious with his time, and we did come up with a few questions about the series that we wanted to ask him.
Question number one. The obvious social issue in a Civil War story is the plight of African Americans vis-a-vis slavery. You certainly included that, but you also included the plight of Native peoples as a major story element. Was this an issue that always interested you? What was your thinking in including that issue in such a strong way in the Kents?
And John Ostrander replied, "How we treated Native Americans was part and parcel, as far as I was concerned, with how we treated African Americans, in that they were thought to be a lesser race. If you think that someone is not quite human, you can justify doing almost anything to them. The treatment of women also falls this way. Mary is not thought of as equal, and certainly before the law she was not. This is a strong part of what makes up this country, and all of it is still prevalent. By showing it in the past, I hope to make the reader more aware of it today."
That is an awesome answer. And I am always a fan of getting some social commentary, social awareness in the media.
Exactly.
All the time.
And if you can do it while also delivering a highly readable story, you've accomplished on many levels.
Mm-hmm. Question number two. The story included a nice mix of historical persons and fictional persons. How did you decide which historical events or persons to include in the story, and were there any others that you wanted to include but couldn't for various reasons?
One of the main points of the story was that I wanted to give a feel of what it was to live in that time. We know who won the Civil War, but those living in those times didn't, just as we don't know how events will turn out in our time. The Kents were caught up in those events, and some, such as Jeb, as you noted, didn't always make the best choices. There were consequences.
Consequence!
Now, John Ostrander's in on the joke, too. That makes me feel all warm inside.
Oh, yeah.
He continues, "I had to select the events based on what told and drove the story and the characters. There was one event that didn't meet that criterion, but when I discovered that John Wilkes Booth once performed in Kansas, less than a year before he would assassinate Lincoln, I just couldn't leave that out."
And frankly, that's actually one of my favorite historical person appearances. With some of the others, there was a certain sense of coincidence of, oh, of course Nathaniel just keeps running into historical persons who are important today and recognizable names. And vast amount of them worked wonderfully. I enjoyed all of them. But frankly, I'm going to disagree with John Ostrander. I think that did move the characters forward, if only because that sequence with John Wilkes Booth and Joshua is one of the best, most uncomfortable scenes in that entire section.
I do think what Mr. Ostrander was getting at was that that scene did not drive the plot forward.
No, but...
But he was able, as you said, to take at least three or four pages and really turn them into a terrific character piece.
Mm-hmm.
So it certainly did not feel forced
not
from a
all.
Reader's perspective. And if I had to... If he'd said there was one scene I put in that I wasn't so sure about, I wouldn't have guessed which one it was. I certainly wouldn't have guessed that scene.
Right. And our final question. This might be an ignorant, we don't know how comic books work sort of question, but you had worked extensively with both Tim Truman and Tom Mandrake before this project. When the art chores changed hands, did that affect the way that you told the story, or was the script already done far in advance and the artist change didn't affect the writing process?
Originally, the concept was that we would have three artists, one for each section. Tim was picked for the first and Tom for the last. The artist for the midsection dropped out, which created a minor panic. Tim said, "Well, I could do that section too if you want," and we wanted. We weren't crazy. It messed up the concept of three artists, but having someone of Tim's caliber and attention to detail trumped that. So it didn't change how I was going to tell the story, because Tim and Tom were already part of the plan.
That is an interesting idea. I kind of wish I could have seen that now, to have that very strict break between the three sections, because as we talked about, each one of them does have a slightly different narrative style, a slightly different genre, if we'll throw out hesitant quotation marks on that. So having different artists for each one would have been interesting. But I love Tim Truman.
In retrospect, I do kind of feel bad for Tom Mandrake.
Yeah.
Because he did end up with the short end of the straw. Because it wasn't just that he was doing one section and there were two other artists. And readers, when they got to his, understood that there would be artist changes built in.
Exactly.
And so for us, when we got to nine, it was noticeable. And it, you know, he only ended up with one third of the story. And Tim Truman gets two thirds of the story. So it does seem like his art dominates and his art comes first. So that's what I had really bought into. And so changing it to Tom Mandrake,
it had an unfortunate and unforeseen influence on our perception, which I feel a little bad for dissing him a little bit now. It's like, oh, he wasn't a fill-in. He was actually supposed to be there from the beginning. Oh. Well, he did a really good job.
I know. And like I said, if we'd been expecting artist change, because it wasn't the first, but it had been the second, and they had done, as you said, different art things with the different literary things, with the different historicals, that transition would not have been as jarring.
So it is a genius idea executed well, but not perfectly.
Yeah, I agree.
Still awesome.
Again, we want to thank John Ostrander for allowing us to ask him some questions and replying as he did. I asked him if there was anything I could plug for him, and he said no, but I'm going to anyway.
He doesn't know how podcasting works. If you've been even tangentially involved in a podcast, you will be plugged.
Plug something. So I wanted to plug his column on the Comic Mix website at comicmix.com, where he writes about issues and topics in the comic book world. And in addition to the Kents, I know his runs on Martian Manhunter and The Spectre are available in trade paperback if you wanted to pick up some of his work. Also wanted to talk a little bit about other feedback we got. I mean, not to diss.
They're just coming second to a great feedbacker, an amazing feedbacker. All of our feedbackers are equally well-loved, except for the ones that are special.
Well, they're all equal. John Ostrander's more equal than the rest.
Exactly.
We've gotten two more iTunes reviews recently. 10 more stars. Thank you very much.
Grammar Merchant reports loving all of our podcasts and said we gave solid synopses, insightful reviews, and thought-provoking commentary. They referred to our network as an anthology of random items of interest, which actually is a pretty good description.
Amazingly accurate.
Yeah. I can roll with that.
Emily was specifically mentioned for bringing her perspectives as a sociologist to bear on Bronze Age comics, and that you gave him hope for a new generation of comics fans. Listening to the Quarterbin podcast, Grammar Merchant, can't help but smile at the nostalgic rush I get.
Aww.
Now, our friends over at the Fire and Water podcast had me on their show recently, and they did a discount bin-themed episode in honor of the Quarterbin podcast. And a lot of the responses both on the show, during the show, and then afterwards, I got from that episode also mentioned the nostalgic feel of that show. And it's probably because I'm a total bonehead, but I never really thought about that show as being primarily about nostalgia. And I'm thinking, in retrospect, if I had designed a show about nostalgia, I probably would have been more specific and particular in the choices and what I was going for. So I'm glad that that's an effect,
yeah,
but that wasn't the goal. I guess it depends on your definition of nostalgia, but some of those books are from within the last decade. And there is something about the differences in someone's age that, to me, the 1990s aren't all that nostalgic.
Right.
It just doesn't seem that long ago, but I'm kind of old.
Yeah, I was going to say, for someone 15, 25 years younger, it's a different perspective.
Exactly. Fellow podcaster Gene Hendricks also commented on iTunes. Gene hosts the Quantum Cast, featuring the character of Quasar, and a more general show, The Hammer Strikes. His iTunes review said, "No matter what kind of comics you like, you'll find something here to enjoy. Prof. Allen and Emily have put together three very entertaining and informative shows that are definitely worth your time." So, thank you, Gene. Thank you, Grammar Merchant. iTunes reviews are very helpful in making the network more visible in podcast directories.
We have also mentioned our buddy Noel Thingvall from the movie podcast I Hate Love Remakes and Masters of Carpentry, which I haven't listened to, but I absolutely should. The Carpenter episodes are my favorites of I Hate Love Remakes.
So Masters of Carpentry is a film podcast about the work of John Carpenter, in case that wasn't obvious.
I mentioned him on one of my episodes. He checked him out, sent us some feedback. We replied to his feedback. He's listened to more and sent us even more feedback.
And he's been working his way through our archives. And on Shortbox Showcase 4, when we talked about our love for miniseries and our wish that comics would do more of them, he replied, "In terms of the interlinked miniseries structure, I really dig how books like Hellboy, BPRD, and Atomic Robo work it, especially given the big jumps back and forward in time that they take. Any ongoing series should be a mix of things. Sprawling stories, one-off tales, mini-series arcs. Writers should be able to use the entire inventory of options, instead of just falling into one, like writing for the trade. Even though some do one better than others, ultimately, I love it when I don't always know what type of story I'm next in for until I'm into it."
That's a great point. I agree. It's something that I've enjoyed my two now canceled runs in the New 52. But even in those, even though I enjoyed the ongoing nature of both Demon Knights and All-Star Western, it did get a little boring almost at times. Less so with Demon Knights, because they were doing time jumps and different types of quests in different areas, and one was against vampires and all that. So I appreciated that, but there
was a sense that when you started a new storyline, it was going to go 4 or 5 or 6 issues until
right.
It wrapped up. There's sort of always is that implication.
And that even none of those endings were really firm endings. There was one sort of where they disbanded and took a time jump for like 10 years or something. So I kind of liked that, but even just variety of endings, that it always was, well, we have reached the end of this arc, but there's more coming because it's still ongoing. And so there weren't even firm openings and closings because they all, every single one interconnected. There were none that stood entirely on their own.
Every story arc wasn't just an arc. but it was the hint or the beginning of where they're going in the next arc.
Exactly. And Noel is absolutely right. I would have loved that. They did an issue zero about a year and a half in or 2 years in, something like that, to across the DC universe to celebrate 12 months of the New 52. There were issue zeros of everything. And I loved the Demon Knights issue zero, if only because it was different.
That was one of the great things about the first Aquaman arc.
Yes.
That I'm not looking at Mike's Amazing World right now, but maybe issue five may have been the totally Mira-centric episode.
So good.
I believe it involved her going to the grocery store.
For dog food, yes.
For dog food was the plot. Mm-hmm. But it was an awesome story. What happened?
And then she kicked ass for Poseidon for like 28 pages. It was wonderful.
But it was a one and done story. And it was one of the highlights of that run. Partly because it was an awesome story. Partly because it was so freaking different from everything else we've gotten.
Yeah. So we'll add that to, not only do we want more miniseries, more standalone issues, more special issues, just more variety.
I like that.
I dig it.
Noel also left feedback on episode 5, where we talked about adaptations. And Noel commented that he would absolutely love to see someone take a stab at doing a comic version of the Neverending Story. Now, that book and movie are too modern for me to have seen them as a kid, so I don't have those nostalgic feelings for them. What's your experience with Neverending Story?
I think I've seen 25 minutes of it in 5-second chunks, all in the wrong order.
It was one of the movies that they had at daycare.
Yep. And you
would drift in and out of the room and in and out of...
And they were always showing the same 10 minutes, like, every single day for, like, 2 weeks. And, yeah. I have gone out on the internet and said before that I don't really like the 90s in a lot of senses. I just don't connect with the pop culture as much. I wasn't reading the comics and don't like most of them in retrospect. I wasn't listening to pop music. And most of the movies from the late 80s to early 90s that people of my age love, I saw like that. Cut up in little bits and pieces, backwards, forwards, repeated. I didn't see more than 10 minutes of E.T. until I was like 17.
Now, I do know in terms of the Neverending Story that there is actually a ton of material there.
Yes.
The book spawned some sequels, which may or may not have been translated into English. But there were some animated and TV episodes as well from the world of the Neverending Story.
Yeah, there's definitely plenty of material. I do know that much.
Yeah, so I think that property probably does make a lot of sense for potential adaptation. So we appreciate all the feedback, and we welcome it.
Send it to relativelygeeky@gmail.com, or you can do what Noel has been doing and leaving comments on each of the individual blog posts at relativelygeekypodcast.blogspot.com.
We mentioned both Mike Bailey and Robin Shagg from Fire and Water.
The Irredeemable, please. Use his proper name.
The Irredeemable Shagg.
Thank you.
Fire and Water. But I wanted to specifically thank them for having us and or me on their shows and welcome any new listeners who came from hearing about Relatively Geeky on one of those shows. We know from the download numbers that there are a good number of people who have found us in the last few weeks. So, welcome!
And if this is the first episode of Shortbox Showcase that you have listened to, I want to do something that is now becoming a bit of a feature. And I apologize if you like Uncovering the Bronze Age, because much like I Hate Love Remakes, that show is basically quarterly. Don't expect frequent content from that one.
Well, Emily, let's talk about what we have coming up in the future on the Relatively Geeky Network.
Nice segue.
We've been doing this podcasting thing for almost a year now, and by the time we do get to that year anniversary, which we will celebrate appropriately, we will have released probably 55 episodes or so. So in that first year, we will have averaged at least an episode per week.
Awesome! That is not going to be true for next year, is it?
Yeah, I don't think we're going to be able to keep that pace as we roll forward.
Yes, I have acquired a wonderful thing called gainful employment in the last couple of months. Yes, yes, thank you, thank you, thank you.
Oh, no, thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you.
So, That is now taking up a decent number of my time every single week, and is part of why it's been a while since I had an Uncovering the Bronze Age episode out. Trying to look into these things like moving out and finding where I want to set up my own residence and all those sorts of fun things.
Now, before anyone panics, we do not anticipate this becoming a Hey Kids comic situation, where that show is ending as a result of Michael heading off to university. So Emily's job is about 15 minutes from us, and she'd be looking for an apartment, probably in that general area. So the idea of us getting together for an episode or two every month does not seem out of the question.
No, and the other reason that my podcast has been so slow has been a multitude of varied computer issues. Hopefully those will get ironed out in the next couple of weeks, and I can finally do something called Download Audacity, because I have been attempting to podcast off of GarageBand, which has worked fine, but is very slow. So between getting a fully functional computer and a better editing program, that should help me keep up my solo work. And then, of course, I can't abandon Short Buck Showcase. This is our bread and butter.
There's bread involved? and butter? Really? Bread and water, perhaps, but I think that has different implications.
Yes, it does.
Now, we are going to take a summer slowdown. Right. Not a summer hiatus. Just a summer slowdown. Like I said, we've averaged about a show a week for a year, but for the next few months, we'll probably be putting out maybe 3 shows a month. So not a huge slowdown, just a few extra days between episode releases. Now, all 3 shows are still in production, and we're adding a special non-comic episode of a 4th show in a week or two. That may just be a one-off, but it would give us a spot in the lineup to do more non-comic book talk, if we wanted to.
What? You can talk on the internet about not comics?
Well, this super secret episode that'll be out in a week or so after this one is sort of about comics. We kept trying to bring it back to comics.
And failing to bring it back to comics.
Look, we were talking to Mike Bailey, and he just wanted to hit the highway like a battering ram on a silver black phantom bike. But it just wasn't working. We kept trying to bring him back. But like we said, on all of the shows, we'll continue. 2 of them are going to be more active, and that ain't bad. Well, that's what we have for the top of the show. So after a few promos, we'll come back and talk about a comic story that introduced one of our all-time favorite characters.
Kalibak, Tassad, it is I, Darkseid. I command you to listen to the Who's Who podcast. Uncover the powers and weaknesses of the Super Friends so that I may destroy them.
Aquaman and Superman, Animal Man and Plastic Man, Firestorm and Nuclear Man, Batman and Hawkman, 2D Man and Hour Man.
Who are all these people, man?
They're all part of the DC Who's Who. Ultra Boy and Booster Gold, Lightning Lass and Hippolyta, Phantom Stranger, Etrick and Arisia and Woody Winks.
Hey, hey, hey.
What?
What about that one guy?
What guy?
Mr. Pretzel, Mr. Lipstick, Mr. Mitzelfuzzle?
Mr. Mitzi's Pitlick?
Yeah, him.
He's also part of the DC Who's Who.
Who's Who, the definitive podcast of the DC Universe.
Available monthly at Aquaman Shrine, Firestorm Fan, and on iTunes and Stitcher as part of the Fire and Water podcast.
Podcasting, the final frontier. This is the Hammer Podcast. It's 30-minute mission to rehash geeky topics, to seek out new bastions of nerdiness, to timidly go where the more talented have gone before. The Hammer Podcast is the official podcast of the blog, The Hammer Strikes. Both the blog and the podcast come from the mind of your average late 30s geek. In other words, insane ramblings about science fiction and fantasy minutiae. If that interests you,
please visit thehammerstrikes.com. Part of the Two True Freaks Internet Radio Network.
And we're back.
We're looking at Batman number 16, cover dated April-May 1943. 64 pages for 10 cents.
Damn it, economy.
We're not actually looking at an issue of Batman 16.
No, which does not cost 10 cents anymore.
We are looking at Batman from the 30s to the 70s.
One of your favorite collections of all time.
Yay! It ranks right up there with Superman from the 30s to the 70s as two of my favorite collections of all time. Now, the fourth story in this issue, whose title we're going to skip because it contains a major spoiler, was written by Dan Cameron with pencils by Bob Kane. Inking is credited to either Jerry Robinson solo or to both Jerry Robinson and George Roussos. There may have been a colorist, but we're looking at a black and white reprint, so...
So there will not be any commentary on that coloring.
Our story begins. Two's a perfect fighting team and three's a crowd in the case of Batman and Robin. And what a crowd when the third is the singular gentleman you are about to meet. Landing in the midst of violence, after a violent crossing of many oceans, nonchalantly attracting violence wherever he moves, this amazing fellow gives America's ace crime smashers the most violent surprise of their lives and makes them like him for it. You have never before encountered anyone quite like him, but you'll be eager to see him again. And now sit back for...
Here comes Alfred!
Yay!
Yay!
We mentioned back in episode 16, maybe, when we did Sidekicks, that, first off, unanimously agreed that Snapper Carr should not have been on the list of
whatsoever
potential sidekicks. But...
Why wasn't Alfred?
Where was Alfred? So, here comes Alfred. Night. In a small passenger vessel, ends a perilous wartime crossing of the Atlantic at a Gotham City pier. So, the two gentlemen get off the boat, an Englishman and, we think, a Frenchman. The gentlemen have similar-looking suitcases, which becomes important. They both go through customs. One of them, in his suitcase, has a book, How to Be a Detective in 10 Easy Lessons. Ah, so you're a sleuth.
And rather good at it, if I do say so.
Stephen Lacey? Have we gotten Stephen Lacey on the show?
Oh my gosh, what a crazy random happenstance.
Oh wow, that was Emily doing her English accent.
Which is almost as good as his American accent.
So this gentleman, who was much shorter and rounder than we have come to expect in later iterations of the character, is Alfred.
Yay!
And as he and the other gentleman exit the pier...
Three swarthy individuals watch the new arrivals with beady, glittering eyes.
I don't sense a single stereotype in that whole sentence.
Well, their names are Manuel, Tomas, and Pablo, so I have no idea what you might possibly be picking up.
Hmm. So, our three gentlemen
yes.
of ethnicity, they follow Alfred... Because he has the same suitcase. And Alfred is thinking to himself, I'm already 2 years late, so it won't matter if I take an hour or two more and follow Le Duc to satisfy his curiosity. Because at the line in customs, he and the Frenchman got into a little conversation. Something about it didn't quite sit right with Alfred.
So he's going to go investigating.
But the three amigos stop him. Give me the valise quietly, and perhaps I shall let you live. Otherwise, you're dead like a dog.
What? Oh, a bally stick-up, such as I've seen in the cinema.
Alfred swings the suitcase like a boss, knocking down two of the three gentlemen, while out of the shadows, Batman and Robin run to his rescue, but he's already pretty much handled the main part of the action. Batman and Robin do really little but beat the guys up and throw them into their own car. With their own driver.
Enabling their escape.
Alfred was doing a much better job of handling the situation.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Hmm.
So they introduce themselves, And Alfred says that he admires them because he's also a sleuth of some...
caliber.
Of some caliber. He admits he's an amateur, but he's trying to learn.
Batman and Robin kind of snicker a little bit and say, oh, well, you know, it's nice to have someone else on the beat and, you know, maybe you could call on us sometime and talk it over as they run away.
And, of course, Dick and Bruce joke about it as they're changing out of their clothes because they didn't even tell him where they lived. So how is this fella ever going to find them? Ring on the doorbell! What could that mean?
So they go downstairs in their robes, ready for bed, and open the door to find Alfred standing on their doorstep at 2 a.m. Good evening, gentlemen. I trust I haven't disturbed your rest.
Huh?
So, their faces in that panel look exactly like it sounds like. Huh?
So he sets his luggage down, and if you'll permit me, then we'll discuss his duties. They are flustered, befuddled, a-humana-humana-humana. Until it reveals, of course, that Alfred is their butler. Butler? But I haven't had one in years. I didn't send for one, and I'm afraid I don't want one. We found we can get along better without servants of any kind.
It may be a bit awkward at first, sir, but I dare say you'll get used to me.
So Alfred is the son of the former butler, and Bruce says, oh, I remember old man Jarvis. He was very kind to me. So, sure, you can be our butler. And then as he departs...
Robin is concerned, obviously, because if they have someone else wandering around the house, they might notice that they... mysteriously disappear every time Batman and Robin are out solving crime, but Bruce says that he can't kick the old man out at whatever ungodly hour this is, and they'll deal with him in the morning.
Unfortunately, Alfred has been followed by our three gentlemen of ethnicity, and they are about ready to break into Wayne Manor, and a silent beam of light awakens Bruce. What? My special burglar alarm. Someone has forced open one of the east windows.
I think that's actually a pretty cool burglar alarm, especially given the fact that there is now another person in the house, which is probably why they mentioned that his burglar alarm goes off by light beam. But that's actually kind of genius, because it shows it has like 8 or 10 lights at the bottom of his bed, so... you wake up instantaneously if somebody shines a flashlight in your face, and then he can immediately tell where the danger is, go get Robin if necessary, and take care of it without waking whoever else might be in the house. But Alfred, being a dedicated butler, is not asleep.
He is going through some of the old newspapers, and he finds out that the man he met at the pier, Gaston Leduc, is actually the Duke of Dorian, a premier... of somewhere in Europe, Bordaria or Sylvania or Latveria or some such.
Some such.
And he recognizes him as a man who's just, you know, escaped the Nazis but is a leader of a European nation.
You know, I just realized that his name is Gaston Leduc.
Oh, and he's...
he is the Duke. That took me a lot longer to figure out than it really should have.
Did Alfred figure that out?
I don't know.
In story, you may be the first person who's figured that out so far.
I will take that.
So a moment later, the gentlemen attack. They steal a treasure. They grab his valise, thinking it has an amazing treasure in it. At which case, Batman and Robin appear on the scene, having to tell us that, well, we came from outside. It's a good thing we didn't just come from down the hall.
It's a good thing that we followed these three guys in their car, which we totally did, you guys. Totally. Batman is shockingly bad at coming up with excuses for where he's come from.
But Manuel is a world-class dagger thrower. So he lines up Batman and throws the dagger at it.
And Robin busts in a pretty good move, and smashes, or intercepts, I suppose, the knife with a mirror as he just leaps in from out of panel.
And then smacks Manuel with it.
Yes, which is a pretty hilarious panel of this angry, mustachioed gangster man.
Just to make sure you have your full quota of bad luck!
Ba-dum-tish!
So, the criminals flee in haste because despite all of Batman and Robin's skills, they've still yet to actually capture these gentlemen in two confrontations.
There is something about whenever you have a crossover or a new character, you've got to make sure that they're on the same par with your main characters. Sometimes that does mean that your main characters get a couple handicaps.
So we're sort of building up Alfred by,
in comparison,
by breaking down Batman and Robin
a little bit. Though to be fair, they were each asleep 12 minutes ago, so I can barely order coffee if I've just woken up. So, you know, the fact that they're able to intercept knives is, you know, no small feat.
So Batman and Robin also leave because, you know, they have to go to their Batmobile and then go to their secret cave because they don't live at Wayne Manor.
Because it's not in the basement, you guys.
Unfortunately, one of the villains that they temporarily incapacitated wakes up, attacks Alfred. Alfred gives a powerful punch, misses.
Hits the wall.
But hits the wall upon which, like, a shield or a coat of arms was mounted. That fell off, hit the bad guy, and revealed...
the Batcave.
Dun-dun-dun! A criminal laboratory and a tunnel leading somewhere beyond. An underground hangar. A plane with bat-shaped wings. It must be the famous Batplane I've heard about. That can be no doubt. Mr. Bruce Wayne is the Batman, and the young maltster is Robin. How clever of me to have discovered it.
Alfred does look really pleased with himself, just like, woo-hoo-hoo, I know the secret identities.
So, moments later, Batman and Robin have followed the bad guys to their hideout, which is a run-down theater, it looks like.
They creep around, to be fair, not very well, walking right out into the center of the stage, which is very easy to see from the balconies, from which our mustachioed and trench-coated thugs throw bolas at them and entangle them, catching them, and then hoisting them above the stage, where they will be left?
Disposed of. Now to finish them! Not yet. Let us do all our killing at once and dispose of the bodies together. These stupid ones will be safe if we tie them together and hoist them into the air. Because, you know, if you've got superheroes,
the
and you have an opportunity to kill them...
The best option is to just tie them up and leave them. Because, you know...
you can always kill them sometime later.
Right, and I mean, it's... what are the odds, really, that a secondary character beloved by fans is going to wander onto the scene and, oh, hey, Alfred.
Hey, Alfred. So Alfred has followed them. He wanders onto the stage. We learn a little bit of his backstory, that he disappointed his father by not going into the buttling business. He became a stage actor for a time, but he gave that up. But this just gives him the opportunity to relive, so he's monologuing on the stage.
A terrible Cockney accent, which I am not even going to attempt to reproduce because my British accent is bad enough.
And we love our listeners in the UK. We don't want to insult Mark or Dave or Steve or Andy and the other ones whose names we don't know. We don't want to insult them either. So we'll just leave that be. Imagine.
Just imagine the most god-awful Cockney accent.
High overhead, an unappreciative audience hears lines of lowbrow melodrama because they're just hanging there.
Trapped for this horrible spectacle.
They manage to swing themselves over, grab with their feet a couple of ropes that they're able to swing down, and finally the rope knocks Alfred's hat off. They finally get his attention, and he sets Batman and Robin free. At the very moment, Manuel and his thugs are entering an apartment in an exclusive neighborhood.
They wake up Gaston the Duke, and rooting around his apartment, find the crown jewels of his country.
To think we brought those jewels secretly half around the world, only to lose them at the end of the journey. It shows what sharp eyes and ears the underworld has.
And it shows how promptly we have acted. Another 2 hours and the jewels would have been in a safe deposit vault. Back at the theater, they carry the body of the unconscious Duke along with the valise full of crown jewels and see that Batman and Robin have waited for them.
But with lightning swiftness, hooded figures plummet from the shadows overhead. You're about to have some distinguished company yourself, and we're it. So they swing down, legs, feet flailing, kicks being delivered. Time to ring down the curtain on this act.
And Alfred does just that, dropping the curtain on Tomas and Mustache. Can't tell which one the other one is.
It could be Manuel.
Could be Pablo.
Who knows?
Who knows?
A fitting finale for a bad actor. Hey, what? And then Batman delivers the best consequence of all, a left hook to the chin. So these were what they're after. But where do they come from and who do they really belong to? Alfred explains.
If you will allow me, I can elucidate. They are the crown jewels of the country of which this man, the Duke of Dorian, is the premier. He brought them here secretly for his government, but somehow these criminals got wind of it.
My friend, you have saved my life and my country's treasures, and to think I laughed when you said you were an amateur detective.
And Batman thinks, somewhat abashedly, he wasn't the only one who laughed.
The following evening, at Stately Wayne Manor, Bruce and Dick are reading the newspaper about how their butler caught the jewel thieves, and they laugh. Oh, it's nice that we gave him credit for this. And again, continuing to sort of make fun of Alfred. At which point, Alfred brings the gentlemen their Batman and Robin costumes.
And once again, they go,
huh? And Alfred points out the window to the bat signal. The searchlight went on a few seconds ago. I believe it means the police require the Batman's services. But Dick says, the signal. But what's that got to do with us?
Why would you?
You forget my deductive abilities. I have known since last night that you were the Batman and Robin, but I saw no reason to mention it till now. They admit that maybe they underestimated their new butler.
And he helps them dress.
Referring to their capes as cloaks, which is pretty awesome.
Yes!
I understand perfectly, and you may rely utterly on my discretion. Your cloak, sir.
That is so classy! This is why superheroes need butlers.
Moments later, the Batplane races through the night sky. Alfred can be useful at that, Batman admits. He saved our lives in the theater. He must be smarter than we think to have seen through our disguise.
Meanwhile, Alfred watches from the window and thinks, they're so impressed with me. It would never do to tell them I learned their identities by sheer luck. Much better to act mysterious and say nothing.
The end of a pretty awesome Colton Hage story.
Oh my gosh, I love this. Let me just say, Dad, I have been waiting and waiting. I am so glad that we have finally had a chance to read some Tintin on the show. Like, I was ecstatic.
No, that was Batman 16 from 1943. That was not a Tintin story.
But what do you mean it wasn't a Tintin story? It was an intrigue adventure story revolving around a set of crown jewels. The antagonists are a trio of, quote, swarthy individuals in trench coats that go around knocking people out and tying them up. There's a ton of well-choreographed comedic action. The art has a lot of round shapes, no shading.
There's no evidence that the getaway car was a Citroën.
But it could have been. It could have been.
I guess that's true.
And there's even... And our new character is even a bumbling detective in a bowler hat who occasionally assists the heroes, but mostly exists as an enduring comic relief character. This was the Tintin story.
He's not Thompson or Thompson. Well, he actually could be either one. He could be both. He's actually probably a better detective than either Thompson or Thompson.
That's not untrue.
There is a little bit of Cigars of the Pharaoh in this.
Mostly King Ottokar's scepter.
Which we did look up, and both appeared in the decade before this story appeared.
I called this one, because one of us has been reading Tintin for many, 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 many years. And as soon as I finished the story, actually about page 2, I was like, wow, this feels familiar. I wonder, oh my gosh, it's Hergé. And a lot of the expressions, mostly on Alfred, because he does have this very wide-eyed, round face. He doesn't look like the Alfred that we see later, the tall, skinny, reserved Alfred. He is a lot like Thompson, or Thompson.
That's actually a pretty amazing deduction yourself.
Oh, thank you very much. And I managed to catch Leduc before you as well. So I'm kind of rolling at this amateur detective thing. I should go find a superhero to buttle for.
Excuse me?
Buttle. It is the thing that butlers do. I learned that from Birds of Prey. That is the only thing I learned from Birds of Prey.
The Alfred on Birds of Prey was not that bad.
No. He was the best thing about that show. Not unlike Doug Jones and Silver Surfer. Doesn't necessarily mean it's a good film or TV show.
But, just to emphasize again, we love Alfred.
Oh my gosh. I love Alfred in almost every incarnation.
What I love about these Golden Age stories that we've looked at, this is the second one we looked at, of course, Detective 27, a few months ago. And we loved in that one, that literally on the first panel, Bruce Wayne and Commissioner Gordon are hanging out. That it laid that part of the legend down at the absolute beginning.
Panel one.
And here, a few years in, we get an Alfred who is similar in character to the Alfred we've come to know. A helper, a member of the team.
Knows the identities, protects the identities, helps keep everything in working order.
The visual is different, as we've said.
Mm-hmm.
But still, at the core, the character is the same. And I even go back to the first appearance of Catwoman, which would have been in between these two.
Right.
And that weird dynamic between Batman and the Cat of vaguely romantic tension is, again, right there from the start. So it really is amazing, particularly here in Batman. We've got with Bob Kane and Bill Finger and Jerry Robinson really creating, at the early stage, things that have lasted for 70 years. Every time it's been rebooted, we get some of these similar character traits and of these characters and of these relationships. Just tells you how strong the base was.
Indeed. And something that I liked about this Alfred is that, again, the Alfred that we associate with is very highbrow and very, to use another British term, posh. That he's got the very upper class, reserved British accent. Whereas this one, he does put on a Cockney accent at one point, but you even just in his normal British accent, is you almost get the sense that it's more North London British than it is even like BBC British. That it's a little bit more middle brow. He's a little bit more of a common man, which then is hilarious when he's talking about being an actor and all of his things, and they make jokes about him being a ham and all that stuff, which he's so nice and sweet and relatable and funny. And let me just say, I see why Alfred has lasted 75 years or 72 by this point. It is awesome.
And, you know, this is the second old story we've looked at here in Batman 75th. We have at least one more Batman-centric episode that we're planning for 2014. It'll be a more modern story, not from the 30s or 40s. But I've really enjoyed digging into some of this old stuff with you.
Agreed. I don't think I'd read any Golden Age comics at all until you picked up the Superman from the 30s and 70s. I read Superman's first appearance just because I made a joke about Super Dickory, and you said, well, it started in the very first one where he's throwing people off of things and busting down doors, dragging people to...
And in Scott Gardner's mind, he's throwing them into the sun.
He could only throw them for 300 meters, guys. He could only throw them half a mile. He didn't gain the ability to throw people into the sun until 1961.
Nerd!
That is my voice of the internet as a whole. But, I mean, that was like one or two issues of that, and then I read these ones. So, I'm kind of digging the Golden Age. It's really easy to make fun of the Silver Age. It is so easy. And it's pretty easy to make fun of the Golden Age, but...
If you're selective... You will, and if you're open-minded, you will find some really interesting stuff there.
Good, interesting things. Because, again, this was not what I would have expected from a Batman comic.
And
because it is almost a straight-up comedy mag.
Yeah, there is
but it's awesome!
It is sort of an action-adventure in the sense that action-adventures these days, in the modern sense, those movies tend to have a sense of humor to them. It does have that surprising mix
yeah.
of sort of the pulp writers trying to tell a kid's story. And so really basically telling a pulp story with some jokes thrown in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they wanted to tell a pulp story with comedy, which means they told a Tintin story. I had to look it up and see how much earlier the Tintin stories had come out. Because when I read this, it seriously was like, I looked at some of the other books that were penciled by Bob Kane that were in the collection. This did not look anything like them. And I thought to myself, when I read it, either they got a different artist for this, or someone is intentionally doing a Hergé homage. And I'm leaning toward Hergé homage, because just the pencils, they do the thing where you turn your face really quickly and there's two faces looking in opposite directions. I did a total. It happened 6 times in like 12 pages.
And I'd never seen that before in any of the stories of this era.
I was like, this does not seem like something that would ever be in a Batman comic. This is something from like Archie or Tintin. Like those sorts of more fun kid-centric as opposed to the sort of pulpy gothic.
Yeah, I wonder what the process was of getting those from overseas into the U.S. in the mid to late 30s. What that process was, or if someone had traveled to Europe and maybe picked one up or seen one before the war even. Interesting to think about sort of how that happened. Or they're just the idea in terms of the story that maybe just other things were in the zeitgeist and Hergé and the writers of this story were referencing the same movie or the same comedy short or the same, you know, it may have been that they were tapping into the same source. Yeah.
But again, this is the problem with reading really old comics. I want to go to a panel and ask them, but they're dead.
Yeah, that is going to be hard. We were able to ask John Ostrander questions.
That will be enough for me.
You may have to settle.
I am content with that. I am content.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap up our episode. Thank you all for listening. So stay tuned for more episodes. Same relatively geeky time.
Same relatively geeky feed.
Ba-da-da-da!